Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus in biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today, we'll be talking to Danielle Whittaker about the new book, The Secret Perfume of Birds, Uncovering the Science of Avian Scent. The untold story of a stunning discovery, not only that can birds smell, but their scents may be the secret to understanding the world. The Secret Perfume of Birds will interest anyone looking to learn more about birds, about how animals and humans use our senses, and about why it can sometimes take a rebel scientist to change what we think we know for sure about the world and ourselves. Well, Danielle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So how are you? How was your week?
Not bad. I'm recovering from a half marathon I ran last weekend, but that went well. So it was a nice time.
Oh, wow. Impressive. Okay. So can you tell us, what do you do?
I'm currently the managing director for the Center for Oldest Ice Exploration, called COLDEX, at Oregon State University. I've just started working here a few months ago, actually. So I help keep the center and its research going.
And what did you study during your graduate days?
Well, I've had quite an interesting path. In graduate school, I did my PhD in physical anthropology. So I was studying primate behavior, conservation, and genetics. I've definitely done a few different things since then.
Oh, wow. That's a very interesting sort of collection of subjects. And how did you arrive to having so many different ones, if I can say so?
Well, the different work with the primates all kind of goes together. So I was studying how gibbons evolved. I was particularly looking at Klaus's gibbons in the Mentawai Islands of Indonesia, and I was interested in their conservation status, you know, how many were left, and that involved studying who they were related to as well. So what other species of gibbons they were related to. So I had to collect fecal samples to take as DNA samples so I could sequence them. And I also surveyed them in a lot of different places and was interested in their behavior, which I didn't really get to study, which is actually the main reason why I changed fields entirely when I went to my postdoc. I was really interested in animal behavior, and it's much easier to work with birds in North America than primates in Southeast Asia. So that was the immediate reason for my change of topic.
And during your journey, did you have mentors that really supported you?
I really did, yeah. In particular, my postdoc. So I changed to studying bird biology at Indiana University, and I worked with Dr. Ellen Ketterson, and she was a wonderful mentor who really helped change the direction of my life. She was very supportive and incredibly supportive of me following completely new directions, and she was a great inspiration and a great example of how to be like a good person in science and how to be a good mentor.
And what would you say to our student listeners and early career researchers?
Oh, I would say, you know, follow what interests you. Treat your research not as a means to an end, but as an end in itself. You know, what you're doing matters. It's not just a step to get somewhere else.
Excellent. So your latest book is The Secret Perfume of Birds, Uncovering the Science of Avian Scent. So how did you come to writing it?
Yeah, so that's kind of a long story as well. To write the book itself, I was actually approached by my editor. She was looking for more women authors for Johns Hopkins University Press. And she had done some research looking up current scientists, and she found me and thought my research was interesting. And I'd actually always wanted to write a book. I was actually an English major in college. I studied literature for years before I turned to science. So I felt like I had a pretty good background in writing and writing for the public. So I was really excited to have the opportunity. In terms of why I wrote this particular book, I guess that's a longer story. If we can talk about that now. So I study how birds use their sense of smell. And when I say that to a lot of scientists, they kind of look a little bit surprised and say, oh, I didn't know birds had a sense of smell. So this is a longstanding myth, both in public and in science, that birds don't have a sense of smell, but there's actually no scientific basis for that statement. This came about when I was a young grad student back in about 2008. I was interested in something else entirely, and somebody happened to say to me, oh, you know, birds don't even have a sense of smell, so I don't know why you would study this other thing. And I was like, wait, what are you talking about? So, you know, as I was saying before, I had studied primates in graduate school, so I didn't have a background in ornithology, and I had never heard this. But I thought, why would this whole group of animals lose something as important as their sense of smell? So I really started digging into it, and I started doing experiments, and I wasn't the only person at the time doing this. This was becoming a topic of research, and it's simply not true. Birds do have a perfectly good sense of smell, but the myth persists. And so it just seemed like a good opportunity to share my research and the research with others on this topic with the general public.
Oh, that's truly fascinating. Oh my gosh. Right. So let's dive into the book. And can we start with the very basics? So could you describe to us, how does the smell work?
Oh, sure. Birds, you know, they use their sense of smell basically the same way we do. There are volatile particles in the air, so small airborne chemicals. And when those enter the nasal passages, you've got this what's called an olfactory epithelium. It's basically a mucus layer on the inside of your nose. Birds have the same thing. And in that mucus layer, there are receptors that will bind with the volatile compounds in the air. They match up depending on their shape. And then that triggers the olfactory nerves to send information to your brain. And then from there, it's actually quite complicated. It seems to involve different parts of your brain, including where we form memories, which is why scent tends to trigger memories in people. And then from there, you know, your behavior can be influenced by that. It works the same way in birds. And they appear to use it the same way we do. So they can get information about each other based on scent. They can sense their environment around them. They can find food. They can sense predators nearby. So everything mammals do, basically.
And how did you go about studying whether birds do have smell or not?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it's not an easy thing to study. But at the same time I learned about this idea that birds didn't have a sense of smell, another person in my lab at Indiana University, her name was Sarah Schrock, she was a graduate student at the time, was interested in the odors that birds give off. So they have a gland at the base of their tail. It's called a uropygial gland or a preen gland. It secretes preen oil. And when birds preen their feathers, you know, when they rub their beaks through their feathers to help groom themselves, they take oil from this gland and they rub it on their feathers. And Sarah was interested in whether this oil gave off odors, and whether that odor changed when they were in breeding condition. And her idea was that maybe they don't want predators to find them, right? And so it would be adaptive if they didn't, if they gave off less smell when they were nesting, so to help protect the eggs and nestlings in the nest. And so she worked with some chemists there at Indiana University, Helena Sweeney and Milosz Novotny, and they looked at the chemicals in birds that were in breeding condition and non-breeding condition, and they found the exact opposite. They found that birds who were breeding actually gave off more smell, which was a little bit of a surprise. And so I saw that. I was like, wow, that's really cool. Maybe that means that birds are using smell in the breeding season. Maybe it's important in finding a mate, you know, same way that mammals do, giving off pheromones, that kind of thing. And so I said, well, first of all, we need to find out, can the birds smell this? And so I took preen oil from, you know, different birds, and I put it on, I actually added that preen oil to the nest of, about 24 different nesting female birds, and I looked at its effect on their behavior. And I found that if I gave them their own preen oil that I had taken, you know, a couple of weeks before, it had no effect. If I gave them the preen oil from a different bird of their same species, it had a little bit of an effect, but I gave them preen oil from a completely different species. They reacted and they got up and they left the nest quickly. So that said to me, they did recognize the smell, and didn't last, right? They came back to their nest, the smell evaporated, so it didn't have a long-term effect, but there was definitely a behavioral response. So from there, I became interested in what information is in that preen oil. So I worked with those same chemists at Indiana University to analyze the content and then compare it to aspects of the birds themselves. So I found that males and females smell different, birds from different species smell different. It correlates with their breeding condition. And then, you know, as the years went by, I kept finding more and more, you know, it gives you information about how aggressive they are, for example.
So what kind of smells are really important to birds? What can they smell apart from themselves, basically?
Yeah, so it's that's a good question. So I think they are able to sense if it's the same species or a different species. And so each species will have like their own species specific set of compounds that gives them an odor. But within that, we find that there is sort of an individual identity available there. So they all have the same compounds within a species, but the blends will be a little bit different. So just like we can tell the difference between two different humans, like if somebody you know really well, like you know their smell if you spend a lot of time with them. I think it's the same for birds. They can also recognize their offspring and their relatives. So birds that are related will smell similar and they can detect that.
Wow, interesting. So does it have anything to do also with the choosing the mate, sort of based, I don't know, maybe on some immune signals?
Yeah, it could. That's actually turned out to be kind of a complicated story. But in some species, here's actually what attracted me to studying this in the first place. Your odor is related to your immune system in certain ways. And this is something that's been studied in humans. We have a very complicated set of genes called the major histocompatibility complex, or MHC for short. And that determines what kind of bacteria your body will tolerate and which ones it will identify as invaders or pathogens, and it will activate your immune system to attack. What was interesting to me was the finding in humans and some other animals that individuals will prefer to mate with others that have different genes from themselves. And the idea here is that if you choose a mate with different genes from yourself, then your offspring will have a mix of those two, and they'll be very diverse and they'll be able to identify a lot of different pathogens, right? And they'll be healthier. And so I was really interested in whether birds do this as well. Which is what sparked this entire thing for me, and which is why someone said to me, well, birds don't have a sense of smell, so they couldn't detect those genes. So different studies are finding different things. Some studies find that, yes, the animals, and including birds, will prefer to mate with birds that have a different set of genes to themselves. But it seems to depend on what's going on in the population. So if you've got, isolated little population, maybe they're endangered and they don't have a lot of genetic diversity, then it might become really important. But if you're looking at, a big population of birds that are not, at any kind of risk of that, then maybe they don't pay attention to it. So there's a lot of variation out there. Honestly, that's one of the things I love about this work is the more questions I ask, the more questions I have. it's not easy to answer.
And what about the environment, the ambient sense?
Yeah, that's a good question too. So birds do sense their physical environment with smell. There's some really great studies looking at how birds use their sense of smell to find food. One of the first was actually by Gabrielle Nevitt at UC Davis, University of California, Davis. She studied how seabirds find food out in the open ocean. And actually what they're able to do is they detect the scent given off by phytoplankton in the sea. And what that tells them is that when there's a large population of phytoplankton, you'll find a large population of fish and squid that are eating it. And that's what the birds like to eat. So they'll fly out over, long distances, and they can detect from pretty far up that scent coming off the ocean, and then they'll dive down and find a fish. And we see that, other examples of birds finding food with scent. But they also respond to other things in their environment. There's a really cool study of blue tits, a little European bird, that when they're nesting, they put these aromatic herbs in their nest boxes, and it helps sort of keep the nest box, it helps fight off ectoparasites, right? It's antiseptic. And they sense, but based on the smell, whether or not those herbs need to be replaced. Right, so they can use it for all kinds of interesting things.
And what kind of birds have you come across during your studies? Do you have your favorite ones?
I have a lot of favorite birds. Most of my work has been with the dark-eyed junco, and this is a widespread North American sparrow. They are usually found like in the mountains or up in Canada, but in the wintertime, they're very common birds at bird feeders throughout the US and Canada. So they're a common little bird, but I find them just really fascinating to study and to watch. I've also worked with lance-tailed manakins in Panama, which are these really cool South American bird or Central American birds that when they interact with it, when they are attracting mates, the males actually pair up. They form partnerships, two males, and they have to do this dance together to attract females, which is just really fascinating to watch. And then I guess my true favorite bird, though, is the brown-headed cowbird. This bird is they are a brood parasite, which means that they don't take care of their own eggs. They'll lay eggs in another bird's nest, another species, and that host bird will have to raise their nestling. And I just find them fascinating. I like to joke that I'm just like them. I don't have any maternal instincts either because I don't have children. But also, it's just interesting that they still grow up to be cowbirds. They still figure out how to be cowbirds, and they still learn their species song. And that must be kind of tough on them. But also, I became interested in their smell. And because I was thinking about, okay, in that first study I did, it was dark-eyed juncos, and I put preen oil on their nest, and I tested whether it affected their behavior. And when I put preen oil from a different species, they reacted. So if that's true, why don't they notice when a cowbird lays an egg in their nest? Does that mean that maybe cowbirds don't give off a smell? And so I got permission to catch some cowbirds too. And I went out and I caught a few cowbirds, and I brought them back to the lab. I actually had them we transport them in little brown paper lunch bags, basically. It's, it's safe for the bird, and you can throw them away so they don't infect, you don't spread disease among different birds. And then I got back to the lab and I opened up the bag with a bird in it, and it suddenly smelled like fresh baked cookies. And I was like, where is that smell coming from? Who has cookies? And I realized it was actually the cowbird smelled like cookies. And so I was, you know, of course, shoving this bird in everyone's face in the lab saying, smell this bird, smell this bird. So I was wrong. They do have a smell. So that's not the reason why, you know, why juncos don't notice their eggs. So that was a hypothesis that was immediately disproven. but I just think they're really interesting birds.
So that's what they put in those houses that are going up for sale, cowbirds.
Exactly.
So do you think it's that sweet smell that is sort of appealing to the birds in the nest that they don't really tend to recognize it as an invader?
That's a good question. I don't know that they leave much of their feather smell behind, you know, they're dropping off an egg and going. But also the other thing I had noticed in that study I did with preen oil is that, yes, they reacted to it right away. But then within an hour, they'd come back to their nest and were back to normal. So if there is a smell, it goes away pretty quickly. So it doesn't have any long-term effect on their behavior.
And that way they can be fooled, basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what roles do microorganisms like bacteria play in the bird smells?
Yeah, that's a great question. So many of our smells and many of the bird smells too are actually produced not by their own bodies, but by bacteria that live in the scent glands. And this was something I had not thought about. So when I was studying all these chemicals in bird preen oil and understanding what was there, people kept asking me at conferences, what's the genetic pathway to produce these odors? You know, what is controlling it? And I had no idea. And then I was giving a talk at a group meeting at Michigan State University, where I worked for 12 years. And Kevin Tice, who became my collaborator, he was a postdoc then, he was looking at my data. And he's like, all these compounds that you've listed are produced by bacteria. They're all known metabolic byproducts of bacteria. Have you looked at the bacteria in the preen glands? And I was like, no, that never occurred to me. At the time, Kevin was studying hyena scent glands. So spotted hyenas in Africa have these scent pouches at their around the anus. And actually many mammals have lots of these kinds of scent glands. And inside there are, there's like a paste, like a green yellow paste. And when they scent mark something, they rub that paste on it. That paste is full of bacteria that is feeding on the secretions of the animal inside the scent gland. And it's actually the odor is produced by the bacteria that the other hyenas smell and recognize as a scent mark from, you know, one of their group members or a different group member. So Kevin and I started looking at the preen glands of dark-eyed juncos. And we took swabs and, you know, used DNA sequencing, and we discovered that there was a very rich and diverse bacterial community in the uropygial gland. And then we did a bunch of experiments to test, you know, whether the same thing was happening in birds that was happening in mammals, whether the bacteria were actually responsible for the odors. So we did one experiment where we injected antibiotics into some birds, and we found that, yes, that changed their odor. And then we did another experiment where we actually cultured the bacteria from preen oil that I took from wild juncos. We cultured the bacteria in petri dishes, and then we measured the odor given off by the bacteria by itself, you know, with no bird around. And it was actually producing the same odors that the birds give off. So that was a pretty cool, you know, I think it was the first experiment to show that in birds, the same process is happening. There are bacteria in the scent glands producing the odors that that birds recognize as their own scents. And I think this is just fascinating because not only is it this like multi-step process that's involving bacteria, but you also pick up bacteria from the environment around you and from the other people or birds you associate with. And so that changes your bacterial composition and it changes your odor. So I'm just currently really thinking about, like, what does this mean for what, you know, what contributes to your odor and what your odor tells someone else about you?
Yeah, that's really interesting because, as you say, it can change throughout time and it can be a sort of a signifier to some really bad alterations and can impact the health as well, isn't it?
Yeah. So if an animal is sick, they'll smell really different, right? Their bacteria will be different. You know, I mentioned earlier that birds that are related to each other smell alike. And another thing that I found is that the reason for that is because they're sharing bacteria. So it turns out that it doesn't actually matter if they're genetically related to their father, for example. So in juncos, like in many songbirds, the father that's raising the nestlings isn't always their genetic father, right? There's we call that extra pair paternity. So the male and female form a social pair, but maybe they mate with somebody outside the pair, you know, just like humans sometimes. But that social mate, he'll still help raise the offspring. But we compared bacteria in the preen glands of the nestlings and their parents. And it turns out they're the same level of similarity to the father, whether he's their genetic father or not. And that's because they're interacting with each other. He's helping to feed them. They're sharing bacteria. And also the same is true for the nestlings in the nest. If they're all full siblings, of course you would expect them to be similar because they're genetically, you know, pretty close to each other. But if they're half siblings, maybe they have different fathers, and that happened at a lot of my nests, they're the same level of similar, you know, at their bacteria and at the smell they give off. So they smell like siblings no matter what.
It's kind of similar that your smell gets quite close to your pet smell.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really interesting finding from studies of humans. You know, if you have roommates or a spouse or a family mm-hmm. that you live with, you all share your bacteria. You also share bacteria with your pet dogs. And yeah, all the people in the house will share that bacteria. It seemed to be, I don't think they studied cats, but dogs in particular, they bring in a lot from the outdoors on their feet. And that ends up on our feet and hands too.
So how different is the olfactory system of birds to other animals like mammals and others?
Yeah, that's a good question, because that's also one of the reasons that some scientists thought that smell wasn't important to birds, is that there is a pretty big difference. In mammals and actually in many vertebrate animals, there are actually two systems of olfaction. So there's the main olfactory system, and that's the one where you've got, you know, the olfactory receptors in the mucus lining of your nose. And if those send signals through the olfactory nerves back to your brain, and that's what you typically use to sense airborne scents, or, you know, if you're a fish, you know, volatile compounds in the water. But there's a secondary olfactory system called the accessory olfactory system. And this involves something called the vomeronasal organ. And in mammals, this is something we'll see mammals using a lot. So like if you're walking your dog and they're really interested in where another dog has recently scent marked or you know, basically peed, they'll kind of open their mouth. And you'll see this in cats too. Like they smell another cat. If you were petting another cat before you came home, or if somebody rubbed on your pants, they'll like kind of open their mouth and show their teeth and like squinch up their nose a little bit. And what they're doing there is giving access to their vomeronasal organ, which is in the soft palate of the mouth. And that system detects some of these bigger compounds, bigger molecules, like protein-based signals. So things that we think of as pheromones are often these heavier protein-based compounds that you won't smell like with your regular olfactory system, but you'll sense it through this vomeronasal organ. Birds don't have this entire accessory olfactory system. For some reason, over the course of evolution, you know, some other things were going on in birds and they don't have those. But that doesn't mean their regular olfactory system, you know, doesn't work just fine. It does. Here's another really interesting parallel. In most adult humans, we don't have that system either. Even though our evolutionary ancestors do, a lot of humans and some of the great apes, we lack it entirely. So I think that's a really interesting parallel between birds and humans, because another fun fact is we also like to believe that humans don't have a very good sense of smell compared to other mammals. And there's also really interesting studies showing that actually we're pretty good at that too. We just don't think of it the same way we think of, you know, seeing and hearing.
Interesting. And do we know anything about the evolutionary history of olfactory system in birds? Is it that our common ancestor had something that sort of diverged into the ones we have in mammals and the one we have in birds? Or is it more like convergent evolution?
Oh, that's a good question. So it's a little bit of both. There's some good studies of olfactory receptor genes. And those are fun to study because, you know, in your eyes, you have like three color receptors, right? In olfaction, it's not like, you know, three smells that make up all smells. It's actually hundreds and hundreds of compounds. So we've got hundreds and hundreds of genes for olfactory receptors that each, you know, pick up different compounds. And it turns out that birds do make quite a few, you know, they make a few hundred olfactory receptors depending on the species, which is similar to what we see in mammals. So there definitely is some shared evolutionary history there that, you know, we've all come from the same common ancestor producing those kinds of genes. But beyond that, within birds, there's been additional evolution. So there are some olfactory receptors, there are families of olfactory receptors in birds that have grown and they've made more mutations and more different genes of these that we don't see in other kinds of animals. So yeah, they've got some shared ancestry with other kinds of animals and that shows up in their olfactory receptors. But birds have also evolved their own. That might be, we don't really know what they do. It's very hard to track from olfactory receptor to the smell that it is responding to, but who knows if it's, you know, bird specific smells or if it's just a different way of them receiving the same smells. Birds are really cool in that like they evolutionarily have evolved different ways to solve the same problem. So we like to say that, you know, bird brains are, you know, you call someone a bird brain if you think they're dumb because birds have small brains. Well, sure, birds have physically small brains because they have to fly, but it turns out that those neurons are really tightly packed inside there, right? So they've got a different solution to the problem of having a good brain, but you still need it to be lightweight so you can fly. So you just see this over and over again in birds. They're so fascinating.
Do you think in the future we're going to see some explosive sniffing birds?
I don't know. I mean, who knows?
So how does this sense of smell impact their behavior? So is it really crucial for birds' relationships, sort of?
Yeah, I think it can be. You know, we were talking earlier about whether birds used odor to choose mates. And sometimes it seems like yes, sometimes it seems like no. But more interestingly, there's some evidence that they actually use smell in other kinds of relationships. So this was a study by Louisa Amo, who looked at the idea was that they had house finches and they were giving them the option between the smell of a male. They were giving males the option between the smell of another male or the smell of a female. They were expecting the males to go towards the smell of a female because you expect this odor is important in mate choice. But they found really mixed results. Some of the males preferred the females. Some of the males preferred other males. And when they looked back at it, they discovered that it had to do with the condition of the male in who was making the choice. So if he was, say, in poor condition and the male scent that he was, you know, smelling was from a male in better condition, he avoided that male and he went towards the female instead. But if the opposite was true, if the male doing the choosing was a good, you know, healthy, strong bird, and he smelled the odor of a male in poorer condition, then he would go towards that male scent. So it seems to be important. Yeah. It seems to be important in competition and aggression. And so I did a study in collaboration with my friend Kim Rosfall at Indiana University, where we looked at whether smell communicated information about aggressive behavior. And studying aggression in birds is actually a lot of fun. If you're looking at wild birds, we would do what's called a simulated territorial intrusion, or STI for short. You have a bird in a cage and you have a speaker, and you find a bird's home territory out in the field. And you carry that bird in a cage and your speaker, you set it down somewhere in the middle of the territory and you play bird song. So we were looking at juncos, we played junco song, and the local male was like, who's on my territory, right? And he hears the song and he comes out and he sees the bird in the cage and he'll, you know, attack the bird in the cage. And the bird in the cage is unhurt, don't worry. It's basically, he just kind of swoops over and sings at it. It's not too bad. But we found that we took those measurements of how aggressively that male responded, and we found that their odor predicted that, right? So we also took preen oil from those males, and there was a relationship between the way they smelled and how aggressively they reacted. So if two males were to meet each other, they could get a signal like, oh, this guy's going to beat me up, I'm going to go now, right? Or, oh, I can beat this guy up, right? So it can be really important at that level. And it could be true in females too. We don't give female birds enough credit, but many of species, females have to work really hard to defend their nesting territory from other females. And smell could play a really important role there as they're, you know, figuring out how to divide up the territories.
So we hear quite a lot about the mate's choice in the female birds, especially something like peacock, for example, that is very visually attractive and signifying that he can be so pretty and still survive and stuff like this. Does the smell impact the mate choice for female birds?
It might. Smell could be important in females choosing a male. It could be important, for example, in sensing whether the male is healthy, whether they're compatible genetically. So we were talking a little bit about those immune system genes earlier. It could tell them whether, oh, this male, you know, has immune genes that I want to pass on to my offspring. It could also be important in other kinds of understanding other aspects of a male's biology. So one study I did with lance-tailed manakins in Panama, we were trying to understand, you know, how females were choosing which males to mate with, among other things, and did certain males smell differently from others. This is the species in which the males form partnerships. There's an alpha male and a beta male, and they do this classic leapfrog dance, and the females, you know, go around and they watch all the pairs of males doing their dances and decide who to mate with. And in this case, they always mate with the alpha male, almost never the beta male. And so we were wondering, do alpha males smell differently from beta males? Does that affect her decision? And we didn't find a difference between alpha males and beta males, but we did find that the odor related to how generally heterozygous the males were. And so heterozygosity is the word for genetic diversity within an individual. So I'm trying to think of the easiest way to explain this. So we have two sets of chromosomes, right? So each gene, we have actually two copies. And if those two copies are exactly the same, that's called homozygous. And if they're two copies are different, you know, one from your mother, one from your father, that's called heterozygous. And generally, we assume that having a lot of heterozygosity in your genome means that you're probably healthier, right? Whereas if you've got a lot of homozygosity in your genome, that could mean that, like, if you inherit, say, a genetic disease that's recessive, then you don't have a chance for it to like be hidden, right? If you have two recessive genes, that's what's expressed. So it's more of an advantage to be heterozygous. But back to the birds, my collaborator, Emily Duvall, had found previously, and her grad students had found previously, that these birds, the females preferred to mate with males that were heterozygous. But there was no obvious physical difference between them, so it wasn't clear how they were detecting that. And what we found when we looked at their preen oil odors is that more heterozygous males smelled differently than less heterozygous males. So that might have been an important signal to the females to decide which male to mate with.
That's fascinating. So what about the city-dwelling birds? How does the environment, especially the air pollution, impact bird smell?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked about that. So we did this study of urban birds in San Diego. So this is a really fun case study looking at urbanization in birds. So dark-eyed juncos are typically not city birds, right? They live in forests, particularly mountainous forests, but the environment's been changing over the last few decades pretty rapidly. And beginning in 1980, people started noticing that juncos were staying on the campus at UC San Diego year-round. Now, they usually only saw them in the winter because, you know, it was too cold and snowy in the mountains, but then they would go back up to the mountains in the summer. And there were maybe a dozen pairs that stopped migrating in the spring. They stayed. And over time, those birds actually very rapidly evolved some differences from their ancestors in the mountains. My collaborator, Jonathan Atwell, who was a grad student in Ellen Ketterson's lab at Indiana, did his entire dissertation project understanding what had changed in these birds. So they're a little bit smaller than the mountain birds. They are they're less aggressive towards each other, which is good because they're actually living, they're city birds, right? They're actually living much closer to each other and they have smaller territories. The males help more with raising the offspring, which is also good because another change is that they lay more eggs throughout the summer. The climate is very mild and nice, you know, at UC San Diego. And instead of two clutches of eggs per summer, they're actually laying about four clutches of eggs. So that takes, it takes a lot more work to successfully raise all of those nestlings. And going along with that, there's also less extra pair paternity, or a fancy word for infidelity. We don't see as many cases of the male not being related to his children. So all of this was going together. And what Jonathan found was that it seemed to be a single change in the system secreting testosterone that then had these cascading effects that affected all of these traits to help them adapt very quickly to this new to them urban environment. And I worked with Jonathan and I was curious about whether the city birds and the mountain birds smelled differently. And I found that they do. There was a significant difference between the two populations. And one of the things I'd like to do in the future is to go back. It's been a while. I'd like to go back and look at whether bacteria is involved in changing that odor, because you would expect that birds living in the city might have different bacteria from birds living in a forest.
And what about their ability to sense smell? So, for example, pigeons who live all around us and especially around the streets where the cars are and exhaust fumes, do they have impaired sense of smell, do you think?
That's a great question. I don't know if anybody has looked at that yet. I mean, I feel like I have an impaired sense of smell when I'm around exhaust. It's so strong. It will block everything out. I think that's a good question that would be helpful to understand how this changing world is going to affect the future of other species, right? Are we interfering with their mate choice? Are we interfering with their normal functions? And we know in some ways we definitely are. There's, you know, like the light levels at night in cities really change animal behavior, especially bird behavior. But smell is this question that there's a lot of opportunities there. Anybody listening wants to study this, go for it.
So what are some of the burning questions you still have that you really want to answer?
Oh gosh, I have so many questions. So I am really interested in this idea of bacteria. Because one of my questions is, okay, we've got these odors and they actually tell you a lot about the individual, like the individual bird. It will tell you a lot about their, you know, what sex they are, how healthy they are, whether or not they're breeding, et cetera, you know, who they're related to. But if that odor is produced by bacteria, and if we can change our bacteria by interacting with different birds, right, if they can change depending on who they're interacting with, and that changes their odor, then how does that information stay reliable? And this gets really complicated really fast, but I think the immune system is probably involved. I think it comes back around to those immune genes, the MHC immune genes, that will be affecting what bacteria our bodies tolerate, right? So you would only keep the bacteria that your immune system didn't attack. And so that could still be a way that it affects your odor in a way that relates back to your biology. But like, this becomes so complex, it's pretty difficult to figure out the right way to study it. So that's a plan I have coming up, is to look at that and what really controls our bacteria, what really controls the odor that they give off. But yeah, I change, you know, I get interested in so many things and I follow questions down these little rabbit holes all the time.
And what about the caged birds, something like chickens, for example, that are bred in a big farms, and especially if they're given quite a lot of antibiotics as well? Does this really impact their health, do you think, in this kind of area, in a smell area?
I'm sure it does. One thing we found in our own work is that when you bring birds into captivity, their bacterial communities change pretty quickly. In our study, we found that they became much less diverse. It could also be that they are, you know, sharing bacteria, you know, pathogenic bacteria with each other, which is one of the reasons why they're given antibiotics. And we also know from a study I did that antibiotics affects the smell you give off. It affects the bacteria, so it kills off a bunch of the bacteria and you're not making your regular smell. So yeah, I would expect that captive, you know, egg laying chickens on farms or you know, meat chickens on farms would have very different smell from a wild chicken. And yeah, that would potentially affect a whole cascade of behaviors.
And now, thinking about the bigger picture, so why do you think it is important for our society, for scientists, researchers, like somebody like you, just really go ahead with very interesting and curious, you know, mindset that you want to find out much more in detail about something that no one else, well, I'm not saying not no one else, but quite a few people were thinking about.
Yeah, I think it's really important to question our assumptions. The whole reason I started studying birds' sense of smell was because somebody claimed that birds didn't have a sense of smell. And so many people had never questioned that assumption, and it just sounded wrong to me. And if we, you know, if we hear assumptions like that and we don't question them, then it leads to us not knowing stuff about the world around us, right? Like there's still so much to ask and know, and it's important to be curious. And I really care a lot about basic science. You know, some people think, well, what's the point of that? You know, you're not curing cancer, you're not saving endangered species, and you know, that's true. But there is really about important value in appreciating and understanding the world around us. And to do that, you've got to be curious.
And what discoveries on your journey to writing your book, The Secret Perfume of Birds, surprised you the most?
Oh, I think it all surprised me. I wasn't surprised to learn that birds had a sense of smell, but I was surprised that my simple little experiment worked so conclusively. I have found over and over that it's always much more complicated than I expected. Bodies are complicated. And then when you bring bacteria into it, you discover it's even more complicated. I think it's all just been a really eye-opening quest to understand what's going around. And I guess I do know more than I did when I started, but I know more about what I don't know already, you know?
And do you ever ponder what kind of smells did dinosaurs produce? Non-avian or avian ones? Do you have like a favorite dinosaur you really like to smell?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're pretty sure that dinosaurs probably had similar capabilities to birds when you think about smell. So we don't know a lot about it. I did see this great exhibit at The Los Angeles Museum of Natural History had a great exhibit about dinosaur senses. And I was like really worried that they were going to say, oh, well, you know, dinosaurs didn't have a sense of smell, but I found the smell section and they're like, yeah, they probably did. And here's some ideas about that. My favorite was actually always the Brachiosaurus. I like those big herbivorous, gentle looking dinosaurs. And I bet the herbivores probably smelled better than the carnivores. So yeah, I would like to smell a Brachiosaur.
Fair enough. All right, well, this has been a fascinating discussion. So could you tell us, what are you currently working on and what will be your next project?
Yeah, I've actually taken, since publishing the book, I've taken another huge turn in my life. I took an opportunity to run a new research center. So for 12 years, I was the managing director for the Beacon Center for the Study of Evolution in Action at Michigan State University. And that was great, but the center was kind of winding down. And this brand new center here at Oregon State, the Center for Oldest Ice Exploration, opened up and they were looking for a managing director, the same job I had for the same type of center. And I was like, ice, that sounds interesting. And so now I'm here learning about ice in Antarctica and ice coring and using those air bubbles in the ice to understand what the climate was like millions of years ago. Brand new field for me. I think it's fascinating. I don't know that I'll personally do research in this area, but I sure am learning a lot. And I'm looking forward to someday going to Antarctica with some of the scientists and helping drill ice cores. I think it'll be fun.
Oh, wow. That is incredible.
Yeah, I describe in the book like how I've taken all these weird turns. You know, I started as an English major, PhD in anthropology, postdoc in biology, and now here I am studying ice cores. And you know, we like to think that these scientific careers have this very straightforward path, and I just want everyone out there to know that it's not always like that, and it's okay if it's not like that, right? Like, life can take some interesting turns, and I think that's great.
Astrobiology is going to be next.
I hope so. That would be fun.
And where can our listeners find more information about your work and also your book?
Yeah, so if you just Google The Secret Perfume of Birds, you should find me. I think I'm the only person with that title. You can also Google my name, Danielle Whitaker. Yeah, I'm pretty easy to find on the internet.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.